You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you're wondering if you should travel up north this summer, you're not alone. We'll talk about a new piece from WisContext that looks at some of the concerns over tourism and the coronavirus. First, if you wanted to research, say, artist Frida Kahlo in American newspaper archives, you might get better results if you look for the name Mrs. Diego Rivera. For decades, it was common practice for women to be referred to as Mrs., their husband's name. The New York Times' new project, The Mrs. Files, is exploring the pages of the past to examine how marriage and the titles that came with it shaped society and women's identities. Amy Padnani is an editor on the obituaries desk at The New York Times and co-creator of The Mrs. Files. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I understand some of the inspiration for The Mrs. Files came from some confusing experiences going through the old photo card catalog at The New York Times. Can you tell us some of that origin story?
Yeah, that's right. So as you mentioned, a couple of years ago, I started a project called Overlooked, which writes the obituaries for women who never got them. And as my team did its research, we found that sometimes it was difficult to find out whether we had done an obit on a woman because she was referred to by her husband's name. As you mentioned, Frida Kahlo, we did have an obituary for her, but in it, she was called Mrs. Diego Rivera. So soon after Overlooked, we started another team called the Archival Storytelling Team, and we were tasked with telling stories about our past based on our archives, kind of like Overlooked. We have this room in the sub-basement level of our building that we call the morgue that has dozens of old photographs that we wanted to digitize. And in the process, we found it really peculiar that the folders often referred to women by their husbands' names. There were some really well-known women. Coretta Scott King's name was typewritten over an area that was whited out. We believe that one said Mrs. Martin Luther King Jr. And when we looked for pictures of June Carter Cash, the catalog directed us to Cash, Johnny and Mrs. So we found this really strange and thought it was worth digging into a little deeper. We found out the practice was not just done at the New York Times, but by society as a whole. And we took a deeper look into the history and the honorific of Mrs. and what it means to women and their identities. So that's how the Mrs. Files came about.
One of the subjects of pieces in the New York Times back in the day didn't want to put up with that. We know her now as Amelia Earhart, but she had to, you know, work with the New York Times to be called that in the pages. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, we referred to her by her husband's name as well. We would call her Mrs. Putnam or Mrs. George Putnam. And she knew our publisher pretty well. She wrote a letter in 1932 saying, hey, can you stop calling me Mrs. George Putnam? You know, actresses and writers are referred to by the name they wanted. So I think a famous pilot should get to choose her professional name as well. And so the Times agreed. And in our archives, you'll see some cases when she was referred to as Mrs. Putnam. And then after the letter in 1932, she's referred to as Amelia Earhart.
You and your colleagues dug into the history of this concept of calling a married woman Mrs. husband's name, and it didn't go back as far as I might have thought it had. Could you share with us how this whole practice started?
Yeah, you know, it actually began with the idea of social status. Mrs. is short for mistress, which doesn't mean the same thing that we think of it as today. A mistress was more about the amount of wealth or your social status, which sometimes you would get through marriage. So so it was, you know, a respectful term. And Mrs. became more associated with marriage just sort of gradually over time, particularly after World War II, when women were being encouraged to get out of the workforce and back to domesticity, back to homes, back to marriage. And a lot of them took pride in their marital status. So they embrace the term Mrs., and that's really where it came to be and how it became popular.
We're talking to Amy Padnani with the New York Times, co-creator of The Mrs. Files, a project we're talking about, looking in part at the days when women were called Mrs., their husband's name, and more widely at what that title and marriage mean about the status of women. And Amy, you wrote a piece for The Mrs. Files project looking at the idea of marriage as a prize for women. What were some of the things you thought about there?
You know, I looked at how even when you take away the honorific Mrs., women are often taught, and young girls are taught through pop and social culture, that marriage is a prize. You hear it in songs, you see it on TV, you see it in movies where the happy ending is a marriage. But there's really so much more to a partnership than just simply getting married. It takes so much more work. And I found it rather frustrating to continually see this image again and again. And so my essay explores, well, why is it exactly that we keep on getting sort of barraged with this image growing up, when modern women have found various ways of fulfillment, of fulfilling their lives?
And now, getting back to the Mrs. title, obviously the New York Times doesn't do this anymore. What led to the change back away from referring to women by that Mrs. title?
So we finally adopted the honorific Ms. in 1986. That term came, it was kind of loaded at first. A lot of people associated with radical feminists, you know, there was Ms. Magazine. But soon it became known that women should actually, you know, have the choice to reveal their marital status. Why should they have to be called Mrs. or Miss when Mr. doesn't indicate a marital status for men? So we hired our first ever female copy editor in 1956, Betsy Wade. And slowly, this cadre of women in the newsroom kind of banded together for various issues that they cared about. And one of them was adopting this honorific. Betsy told me that one day she remembers editing this story where a physician in Vietnam was referred to as Mrs. rather than doctor, just simply because she was lumped in a description of all the nurses. And it really made her angry. So there were, this is not the only instance. This came up again and again. There were protests outside the building for feminists insisting on the honorific Ms. It was a really big deal, a lot of debates, a lot of meetings, and finally the male leadership decided that they would adopt Ms. in 1986 and give women the right to choose.
Mm-hmm. 1956, Betsy Wade started. 1986, the change was actually finally made. So this was not an overnight change.
No, definitely not. It took a lot of, you know, riling up in society as a whole through the 1970s, through the feminist movement, I think, before the Times was able to catch on.
We've touched on just a couple of the things you're talking about in the Mrs. Files. What else is up there? What can we look forward to in the future as it continues?
Yeah, so we might have another installment in the next few months. Initially, we weren't certain about it, but it seems like there's a lot of strong reader reaction, a lot of feelings of identity that came up. And there were a couple of topics that we want to explore more, perhaps looking back at Black women and honorifics, because there's a whole history there of issues of respect. That might be one story we dig a little deeper into. Other than that, I'm not entirely sure. For this one, we had hired three poets to write poems about the honorific and what it means to them, and those were also really powerful. So we might explore something like that again, too.
In a way, as you go back through the archives, I imagine it, I don't know, I look at these stories and think, oh, this is so quaint and old-fashioned, and then I think it really wasn't that long ago that all this was going on. I don't know, what is your sense of the history as you dig into these files and see how things have changed?
So interesting, because history just reveals so much about who we are as human beings. And I think that exact question all the time, you know, it wasn't that long ago. And what does that really mean for our future? If somebody 100 years from now is looking at our practices today, what are they going to think feels kind of backwards? Or what are they going to think was right? You know, it's really kind of incumbent on us to think about these sorts of questions as we go about, you know, our day-to-day.
Amy, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Amy Padnani is a New York Times editor. We've been talking about the new project called The Mrs. Files, a historic look at what titles and marriage mean for women's identity. Coming up next, we'll talk about some of the risks of summer travel to northern Wisconsin amid the COVID-19 outbreak, especially for rural communities with fewer hospital resources. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Twitter fact-checked misleading posts by President Trump, and the president threatened to shut down social media sites. We'll talk to a national political reporter about this and other top stories in national news. First, summer is approaching quickly, and that means a lot of us are starting to think about whether or not we'll travel. For many people in the state, summer vacation often includes a trip to northern Wisconsin. But there are concerns about an influx of tourists and what it might mean for those smaller rural communities that might have fewer hospital resources. Ryan Weichelt is an associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. He recently wrote an essay for WisContext titled "The Hazard of COVID-19 Heading Up North for the Summer." Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, so far, what do we know about how the coronavirus outbreak has been playing out in the northern parts of the state?
Yeah, for what data that I've been able to sort of watch, again, I'm not going to claim to be an extreme medical expert here, but it seems that COVID has been somewhat limited in the northern areas of Wisconsin, and specifically in some of the rural areas. So I guess compared to southern Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin has certainly weathered this much better.
And as you wrote in your piece, and we've talked about on the show early on, looking back, I think, to March, some counties that depend on tourism a lot for their economies said at that point, please don't come. Stay home for now. Don't spread the disease here. Can you talk a little bit about history of them, the concern that we might spread the disease from southern to northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly couldn't have been an easy thing for any of these county executives or tourist boards to say, please don't come up here. You know, they depend a lot of their revenues associated with the tourists coming up, and specifically with Memorial Day has now passed, making sure that these persons come up. But, you know, also I think realizing the gravity of the situation that if an outbreak were to occur in any parts of northern Wisconsin, a large outbreak, you know, is there enough medical facilities to support that? And in the immediate area, there just aren't a whole lot of medical facilities available for a large outbreak in that particular case.
Well, I wanted to dig into the heart of the piece you co-wrote that's up at wiscontext.org. You tried to figure out who owns second homes in what we think of as northern Wisconsin and where they might be coming from. How did you start to try to figure out what sounds to me like a complicated thing to figure out?
Yeah, we kind of stumbled across this, treasure trove of data that was coming from the Wisconsin State Cartographer's Office, where they were able to link together as much as they possibly had all the different counties and the parcel data associated with that. So the parcel is the individual land that any of us might own property would be considered the parcel owner. That information had some pretty amazing data, and besides the value of the property, how big the property was, it had the tax address. So where the tax bill that was sent out when the counties are looking for their taxes in December, we came to the conclusion of, hey, I think we can kind of figure out this crazy question of who actually owns the Northwoods of Wisconsin by simply looking at where these tax addresses were coming from.
What did we find out?
Yeah, so, you know, if anyone, you know, I grew up in Wisconsin, and there's always this sort of mindset that Illinois owns all northern Wisconsin. Specifically, if you've been in the Minocqua area or the Eagle River area. But to our surprise, there was obviously, as geographers, we were excited to see these spatial patterns. We were surprised how much property was actually owned by people in south of the area in the state of Wisconsin. As a whole, about 36% of the parcels in northern Wisconsin are owned from out-of-state persons, as well as people outside our study area. And within Wisconsin, that's about 19% of those persons, many of them coming from the Milwaukee and Madison area.
And that means a chunk of them are owned by people, I suppose, who live in northern Wisconsin itself?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big chunk of those persons that actually live in our study area. About 58% of those properties are owned by that. But even if you look at where the properties are located, most of the property along the most expensive places, especially on the lake shores, they're owned by the people from outside the area.
And what do we know about where those out-of-state people are? Do we see clusters of owners owning land in particular parts of northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, certainly. It's interesting if anyone can kind of put their Wisconsin county map in their head right now. You kind of draw a line that goes right through the center of the state, kind of going through Taylor County. The counties east of Taylor County tend to be more persons from that Milwaukee, Madison area, Illinois, tend to kind of dominate the parcel ownerships of that particular place. If you move westward from Taylor County towards Minnesota, things change pretty quickly. The biggest landowners tend to be, besides the people living there, those persons from Minnesota.
We're talking about a new WisContext report about tourism in northern Wisconsin amid the coronavirus pandemic, and looking at who owns what and where and what it can mean for who's traveling to different places. Ryan Weichelt is with us, associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. Now, again, you're not on the medical side of things, but the concern is a lot of the places you just described have higher incidences of COVID-19 or have had than the counties that people might be traveling to visit that second home.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you just saw the numbers that came up this afternoon, they did, you know, we had the highest increase that the state has seen so far. And the vast majority of that, they said, was coming out of the southeastern part of Wisconsin, where many of these second homeowners might be vacationing from.
And what do we know about what's happening now? Do we know if travel is kind of getting back into gear like it might have been before these shutdowns?
I didn't actually go up there over the this past weekend, but it seems indications are that people have been traveling up there, and they're traveling before Memorial Day weekend. My colleague, Dr. Ezra Zeitler, was teaching a tourism class this semester, and he actually had a student that owns property, their parents own property up in the Tomahawk area. And she, for her paper, was actually kind of looking at who was owning the parcels and certainly noticed that a couple weeks ago that there was a lot more people kind of inhabiting their second homes than maybe you would expect. So people have been kind of moving into the area, coming back and forth. I don't know what the magnitude is. I'm doubtful it's as high as it normally is, but needless to say, things seem to be turning back to normal. I just saw a story that they might be having the Hodag this summer in July in Rhinelander area. So you can see there's some semblance of normalcy trying to return to the area.
In your piece, you also talk a little bit about the history of northern Wisconsin and how it developed into a tourist area and then saw these patterns where a lot of people from outside the area own these choice properties. Can you share a little of that?
Yeah, I mean, you go back to, you know, after the land was sort of colonized by white persons taking the land from many of the Native American areas. But needless to say, when those areas began transitioning, it started as a logging area. And then with the logging area came the rail lines, and the rail lines brought people into these areas. And as after World War II, with the affluency that was happening in many places with the automobile and the highways, you see these people had more money, were sort of traveling up there. And so if we think about people in the 50s and 60s that have sort of experienced going up to the Northwoods, you know, going to the lakes, enjoying the winter activities associated with that, I think when you get to the 70s and 80s, they started buying property. They wanted to maybe sort of relive some of that childhood that they had, and they wanted to give that to their kids. And so you kind of see, you know, one of the jokes that Ezra and I sort of make with this is that every parcel has an interesting story to tell, and I wish we had time to ask all 700,000 owners what those stories were. But it would be, I think many of those that we have talked to talk about that connection that they had as children and experiencing that stuff in the Northwoods.
You also look at kind of haves and have-nots, the parts of that of the northern Wisconsin region that have the really choice lakeside property and get that influx of tourist money and tax money versus those that don't. And how does that affect local spending in schools?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that was one of the biggest parts. We have a piece that hopefully will be published in the next year or so, kind of analyzing and looking at the impact on school districts. You know, one of the school districts we looked at was the Northland Pine School District, which is around the Eagle River area. The amount of money that gets brought in from those second home owners is pretty impressive. And, you know, the school district itself is only about 1,300 students, but they're in the top 40 for the amount of tax revenue that gets brought in because of the properties associated with that. And, you know, if we can also look at in the Minocqua area as well, where the prices of property along the main lakes, there's some places if you go up there, $4, $5, $6 million homes, that's a lot of tax money coming in. So, you know, going back to the question you asked earlier, the difficulties of locals saying stay away, you know, you got to kind of do this balancing act to not drive away second home owners into the area while enticing them to come in because of the benefits for schools, for one thing, and their spending associated with that. Extremely important.
That's okay. You mentioned this treasure trove of data, and we're talking who owns property in northern Wisconsin. I know rental houses and cabins and whatnot are a big part of the story. Is there, do you think, a magical treasure trove of easily accessible data that could give you comparable information there?
I guess, there's just so much data associated with all these different things to make these larger connections. It would take Ezra and I 30, 40 years, I think, to dig through a lot of this stuff. But I know the rental aspect is certainly another fascinating part that is part of that story to tell of the Northern Wisconsin experience.
But even without that, bring it back home to COVID-19. What can this kind of data tell us about what we know about, the travel flow of us humans from one place to another and what it might mean for the spread of a disease?
Well, I think it's very important to understand where your persons are coming from. If we know that there's a certain outbreak happening in a particular spot, we could turn to this type of data to sort of look at where are many of these people coming from to kind of start thinking about contact tracing and those particular things. I think it's, as a geographer, we're very fascinated at looking at these spatial patterns, and having some of that information just provides additional evidence and support for locals to try to kind of deal with what's going on.
Ryan, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Okay, thank you so much.
That's Ryan Weichelt, Associate Professor of Geography at UW-Eau Claire. He was with us to talk about an essay he co-wrote for WIS Context, looking at some of the risks of summer tourism and coronavirus in northern Wisconsin, and breaking down, as we were hearing, who owns what kind of property and where do they come from and where would they be traveling from. You can find the piece online with a lot of maps at wiscontext.org. And if you have a story to share, if you are one of the people with the story behind that property, that second property, whether you are from that region or you travel there regularly in the summer, we'd love to hear your story. If you usually travel up north, are you maybe changing your plans, holding off, or going full bore? If you live in an area that relies on tourism anywhere in the state, what are your hopes? What are your fears? You can reach us in a couple of ways to share your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know your story about tourism here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we're going to check out some of the top stories in national politics. Among those stories, the president's recent threat to move the Republican National Convention out of North Carolina over concerns about their ongoing restrictions related to COVID-19. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, COVID-19 has had a big impact on our economy, including for nonprofit organizations. We'll talk about a new report that looks at some of the challenges nonprofits in Wisconsin are facing during the pandemic. First, it's our weekly roundup of top stories out of Washington. President Trump is in the midst of two controversies on Twitter, and he's threatened to shut down social media sites. As he writes in one tweet, Twitter has now shown that everything we have been saying about them and their other compatriots is correct. Big action to follow, end quote. Twitter began adding a fact-check feature to at least some of the president's tweets opposing voting by mail. It hasn't done the same for tweets from the president pushing a long-debunked conspiracy theory about MSNBC host Joe Scarborough. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the new occasional fact-checking feature of the president's tweets? Do you think the platform is overstepping its bounds? What do you think about the president amplifying that conspiracy theory? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tolu Olorunipa is the White House reporter for the Washington Post. Tolu, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, a lot going on with the president and the Twitter platform, one of his preferred methods of communication. Let's start with this, the voting by mail issue. Can you remind us what the president has been saying about voting by mail as some states try to expand access to mail-in voting?
Yes, the president has very much really rallied against the idea of vote by mail on a massive scale. He has said, without evidence, that voting by mail leads to massive fraud, that Americans and states that decide to hold their elections allowing with the option of vote by mail are opening the door to massive fraud. And he's really opposed some of the efforts by governors to start implementing more expansive use of vote by mail, in large part due to the fact that gathering in large crowds, gathering in long lines is not advised at this time due to the coronavirus. And a lot of these governors are looking for alternatives, and they're looking to vote by mail as an option for both the primaries and the general election in November. And President Trump has been tweeting multiple times saying that vote by mail is not safe, that it's rampant with fraud, and that anyone who implements a mass vote by mail system is opening the door to all kinds of illegal voting. And that's why Twitter decided to basically fact check the president and add a label to some of his tweets and essentially say that, you know, even though the president is saying this, we're adding this label to allow the public to know that what the president is saying is not true.
Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about Twitter and how it handles this kind of thing, and I think we're going to be doing that actually on Friday. We'll have a conversation about that. We could stay with the political side of things here. What was the president's response to being fact-checked then by Twitter?
Well, he has pushed back very hard. He has essentially said that he is threatening Twitter with action. He's saying that this validates his concern, his longstanding concern, that Twitter and other social media platforms are biased against Republicans, biased against his administration, and that he is looking to take action. He said big action to follow. He hasn't exactly said what he's going to do or what that action would be, but the federal government does have some power to potentially regulate or punish some of these social media platforms, and I imagine that his administration is looking for different ways that they might be able to exact some kind of revenge on these private companies for taking action. The president hasn't specified what he's going to do, but at least he's going to use his bully pulpit. He's going to even use Twitter itself to attack the company, to rally his supporters against the company and try to raise the idea that he is being discriminated against and that these companies are all biased and actually are interfering in the election to oppose him.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post, looking at some of the big stories in national political news this week. Staying on Twitter for a little bit, Tolu, we had the president made tweets about Joe Scarborough, former congressman from Florida, MSNBC host, frequent critic lately of the president. One of the tweets, when will they open a cold case on the psycho Joe Scarborough matter in Florida? Did he get away with murder? Some people think so. Quoting here, why did he leave Congress so quietly and quickly? Isn't it obvious what's happening now? A total nut job. That tweet from the president. Can you give us a backstory? I don't know. This takes some setup. Can you tell us what's going on there, Tolu?
President Trump and Joe Scarborough used to actually have a pretty decent relationship. President Trump would go on the Morning Joe show on a regular basis back in 2015 and early 2016. And that relationship has really led to a major falling out. And Joe Scarborough is one of the president's toughest critics in cable news. And some of the attacks from President Trump are essentially more personal in nature. Essentially, the president has said that Joe Scarborough is guilty or should be investigated for murdering one of his congressional aides back in the early 2000s, a woman who died after having a medical episode in his Florida congressional office. She hit her head. She died. The medical examiner looked at it and said that this was a tragic accident. President Trump is sort of essentially pushing a conspiracy theory that Joe Scarborough was actually involved in the death and that he is worthy of being investigated.
And the widower of the woman who had died years ago wrote to Twitter asking for the tweets to be removed. I'll quote a little bit from his letter. I'm asking you to intervene in this instance because the president of the United States has taken something that does not belong to him, the memory of my dead wife, and perverted it for perceived political gain. Twitter responded, didn't remove the tweets and no fact checks on those. Again, staying with the political response, there's been some criticism, Tolu, even from some Republicans. I believe Congresswoman Liz Cheney and Senator Mitt Romney, both Republicans, have spoken out against the president's continued repeating of this conspiracy theory online and now at some press conferences.
Yeah, Republicans, a lot of them are not saying anything. You don't see very many Republicans standing up for this tactic that the president is using. You don't see many of them actually repeating his claims. Most of them are being silent, which can translate to sort of a disapproval via silence. Some are actually speaking out, the ones you mentioned, especially the Wall Street Journal editorial board, known to be run by conservative writers, basically said that the president should stop doing this, that it's beneath the office. And you have to remember that the president is trafficking in a conspiracy theory, not only just a conspiracy theory against a famous cable news host, but also against a dead woman, a woman who died almost 20 years ago at the age of 28. The president is insinuating that she was involved in some kind of affair and that her death was a part of a scheme, a plot. And the woman's widower essentially has written to Twitter saying that this hurts his grieving process, that it essentially makes her memory something that is tied to these nasty political games and not more about the life she lived. And he asked that that these tweets be removed from the platform. Twitter did not decide to remove these tweets, but at the same time, they decided to add a label to some of the president's other tweets, showing that they are willing to take some action against the president when he spews things that are just not true or that are based on conspiracy theories.
We're talking to Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa. It's our Week in Washington News Roundup. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Twitter and other social media sites have a responsibility to fact-check the president's tweets or communications from others as well? Should they delete those tweets as requested by the widower we were just talking about there, about this debunked conspiracy theory? Is there any responsibility for social media websites to police talk from politicians, or should it be a free zone and voters and readers decide? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Many of you have. Christine wrote, it's sad that they have to, referring to these fact checks. But Christine says, too many falsehoods to ignore. Scott wrote, yes, these are private companies. They have an obligation or responsibility to ensure their services are not used by those in power to deceive the people. A majority of people answered yes, Twitter does have a responsibility. But Paul wrote, when the liberal media on most other networks stop undermining the president and our country for their personal agenda, he wouldn't have much reason for being on there. What do you think? You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Tolu Olorunipa. He covers the White House at the Washington Post. We're talking about some of the top stories making news in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or join the conversation about Twitter fact checks of President Trump's statements. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, I want to move over to the House of Representatives. They are going to try a new proxy voting system today, and that's going to have a legal challenge from some Republican members. What's going on there, Tolu?
Yeah, this is the first time in the history of the House that they are trying to do something that would essentially allow House representatives, congressmen and congresswomen, to vote without being physically present in the chamber. This is a longstanding tradition in the House of Representatives, but due to the coronavirus and the fact that it's not safe for large groups of people to gather, the House passed essentially a rules change that allows members to vote by proxy, by having another member who happens to be in the room voting on their behalf. They tried to find a way to do this in a bipartisan way, but they weren't able to come to an agreement. The Democrats were able to push it through. And now there is a lot of pushback from Republicans who are saying that this is not the way that the House of Representatives should be run, that anything that is passed with votes by proxy will not be valid, will not be considered constitutional. And for that reason, there's been a lot of back and forth, a lot of backbiting within the chamber over this issue. And as long as the coronavirus is with us, it seems like this issue is going to be with us as well, because Congress has to figure out a way to pass legislation, has to figure out a way to, you know, do their jobs in a way that's safe. And potentially that means in a way that does not have all 435 members gathered together in the room. And vote by proxy is the way they've decided to do that. But it is not without controversy at this moment, and they're still trying to sort their way through it. And there could be some major legal challenges that have to be worked out in the courts before we know for sure whether or not what they're trying to do is actually constitutional.
In the meantime, they're going to be, I understand, actually using this proxy voting system at least until the courts weigh in. Do I have that right?
That's the plan for now, unless they can come up with a better bipartisan solution. Right now, it seems like they are moving forward. They are planning to hold votes by proxy for, you know, all of the members who cannot be there in person. They'll have a colleague vote on their behalf. And the Democrats who run the House, they have the majority, and right now they are pushing forward with this process. And there are legal challenges. There is the possibility that the courts will rule one way or the other. But right now it seems like they're full speed ahead, trying to move forward with legislation, trying to make sure that they can function as a body, even though they cannot have all 435 members in person, getting on planes, traveling back and forth. A large portion of the House of Representatives consists of older Americans who are, you know, more vulnerable to serious health outcomes from catching the coronavirus. So it's a healthcare issue. It's a constitutional issue. It's becoming a legal issue. So I would say stay tuned, because we are likely to see more on this. But for now, the Democrats are in charge, and they're moving forward with the idea of having proxy votes, having people who can't be in person still be able to cast their votes by having a colleague vote on their behalf.
We're talking to Tolu Olorunipa with The Washington Post, looking at the big news in national politics. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234 about the Twitter fact-checking issue. Charlene is with us between Eau Claire and Mondovi. Charlene, hi.
How are you doing?
Hi, what do you want to bring up, Charlene? We lost Charlene. The phones are being a little dodgy today. She says she believes in fact-checking for Twitter and Facebook. We had a lot of interest in this on social media, Tolu. And I wonder, leading into the next story we'll talk about, given that in-person campaigning is tough, is social media going to be even more important in this election year? And it was a pretty big deal already in 2016.
Yes, and it's becoming an even bigger deal. I was just looking at the Trump campaign spending over the past week, and they've spent almost $1 million just in the last 7 days, just on Facebook alone. There's a major war on the airwaves, and the airwaves now for the 21st century and for the 2020 campaign are being conducted largely on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. The president uses Twitter to make major news announcements, and the fact that these social media companies are grappling with how much of a role they want to play in guarding truth, protecting the public against conspiracy theories, misinformation, disinformation, election meddling. After 2016, they all sort of had to have this major reckoning, and they're still working through it. And there are pitfalls on both sides of the issue, but it does appear that they are looking to make play a more significant role in deciding what they allow on their platforms, how they govern their platforms, how people who use their platforms are governed and controlled and sort of allowed to say certain things and not allowed to say other things based on, you know, potential harm to the public at large. And it does appear that the 2020 campaign, especially with Joe Biden and to a certain extent President Trump unable to campaign in person, that a lot of this is being done on social media and online. And there is also the potential for election meddling. So these social media companies are playing a pretty major role in determining how these campaigns get their message out and potentially determining what happens in November.
That said, there is a lot of attention on what would have been one of the big in-person events, the Republican National Convention this summer, scheduled to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. The Democrats were planning to meet in Milwaukee. It's up in the air as to, you know, how much of an in-person event this is going to be. President Trump is threatening to take it out of North Carolina. What's going on, Tolu?
President Trump is not happy that he has not gotten a yes or no either way on whether or not the convention, the Republican National Convention, can happen in August, towards the end of August, as scheduled in Charlotte, North Carolina. In part, that's because the governor of North Carolina, who happens to be a Democrat, has not been able to forecast what the situation on the ground is going to look like in August, in just a matter of a few months, in terms of the public safety, the public health risk of holding a major convention, tens of thousands of people gathered together at a time when coronavirus is still spreading. Right now, North Carolina is seeing pretty high rates of spread and infections in their state, and they can't forecast that in 3 months everything is going to be fine and we can go back to having major events. Actually, a large number of states can't forecast that far and say for sure that they're going to be comfortable with having thousands of people gather in a convention, because we know that when large numbers of people gather together, there's a large chance that a highly contagious disease like the coronavirus will be able to spread and you could have a new outbreak So that has become a major issue. President Trump has lashed out against North Carolina, against the governor, saying that if he doesn't hear one way or the other very soon, that he's going to make a decision to move the convention out of North Carolina into maybe another friendly state like Georgia or Florida or Texas, where a Republican governor may be more willing to announce that they will take the convention no matter what, no matter what the situation on the ground looks like. So it's become a highly politically charged issue. President Trump seems to want his answers very quickly on whether or not we should be having a convention with large numbers of people gathered together at the end of the summer. The Democrats seem to be moving away, inching away from the idea of having a huge convention, moving more towards some kind of a virtual convention, maybe a smaller event, maybe an event with multiple satellite offices in different parts of the country. But right now it appears that President Trump wants an old-fashioned, large crowd convention, despite the fact that the coronavirus continues to spread in the country.
And finally, Tulu, I want to spend our last few minutes on the politics surrounding the coronavirus itself. Depending on which tracker you talk to, we've either just crossed 100,000 deaths in the United States or we're just about to, probably within the next day or so. How is this being talked about as an issue in the presidential race?
Yeah, this is the central issue of the presidential race. 100,000 Americans have lost their lives to this disease, with thousands of people getting infected on a daily basis, and no sign that this will be completely behind us by the time we get to November. The economic impact has been major and massive, and for that reason, this is the central issue of the campaign. We hear Joe Biden making regular commentary criticizing President Trump's response, saying that President Trump was not on his game at the beginning of this crisis, that he ignored it, that he downplayed it, that he did not act in time. And for that reason, we've lost thousands of Americans. President Trump has tried to defend his handling of this virus. His campaign is out with a new ad today, essentially praising the president's response, saying that even though he's not a Mr. Nice Guy, that he's not polite, he's done what it's taken to get control of the virus, to make sure that everyone who needed a ventilator could get one, to ensure that there was mass testing all over the country. So this is the central issue of the campaign, and a lot of voters are making their decision on who they think would be best positioned to manage the country through a time of crisis, through a time of economic turmoil. And for that reason, this campaign, this presidential election, is very uncertain. There's no clear precedent for this. There's no sign of what exactly might happen. We've never been through a major pandemic like this, right on the edge of a massively important presidential election. So there's a lot of concern about what may happen. There's a lot of uncertainty. The polls have been all over the place, and a lot can happen in the next 5.5 months. And it's clear that this issue is going to determine whether or not President Trump remains the president or whether or not Joe Biden replaces him as the 46th president of the United States.
And briefly, in our last minute, Tulu, we've covered a lot of ground today. What's the story you're watching for over the next week?
Well, one thing I'm watching is the issue of this the FISA court, the legislation to essentially reauthorize what is essentially warrantless surveillance of Americans. It's become highly politicized in the age of the Russia investigation, and President Trump has threatened to veto a bill that is being pushed. And right now, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not Republicans and Democrats will be able to come to some agreement over how to reauthorize this important national security legislation at a time when President Trump is very unhappy about how his campaign was caught up in some of these FISA applications, and members of his campaign were monitored via FISA in part because of their frequent contacts with Russians during the campaign in 2016. So I'll be watching to see what happens. It's a very uncertain process. The president's late decision to threaten to veto this bill, to rally Republicans against the bill, could make it harder for this bill to ultimately pass.
Tulu, thanks as always for joining us today.
You got it. Thank you.
That's Washington Post White House reporter Tulu Olorunipa. We talked to him today about several top stories in national politics, including the new fact-checking feature Twitter has added to some of President Trump's tweets, not all of them so far. You can keep sharing your thoughts on that, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric wrote there, they're considered forums, not publishers. It's an empty vessel filled by users. Once they add content, they become a publisher and subject to different rules. Elizabeth wrote, social media is still media, still corporate owned, and even though people generate some of the content, there's a lot of advertising and manipulation. Elizabeth says there should be public accountability, not just dividends to shareholders. Share your thoughts again on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yesterday on the program, we talked about some of the little things that have given us joy during tough times. You called in with your stories, including a back porch bald eagle sighting and a citywide minute of howling. Here are some more of your moments of joy that you've shared with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christine says gardening always and now more than ever. Lisa tells us she's been painting kindness rocks, gardening, working, photography, doing outside things, trying to help others understand COVID-19. Plus, Lisa says the usual with my four-legged family members. Kendra says reconnecting with my family, leisurely cooking, taking it slow and easy. Speaking of cooking, Sherry says she finds joy making dinner with my housemates every night. At 6 p.m., we all have to stop and make food no matter what. Mike tells us he's enjoying every moment. For some, it comes naturally. Others have to work to learn it, but it's a great opportunity to learn it now. There's beauty in any moment. As Emily Dickinson stated, to live is so startling, it leaves little time for anything else. Mike also says gardening, cooking, daily walks in beautiful nature. And finally, Lisa seconds gardening and cooking. Washing and spinning wool to make yarn all help, Lisa says. Some days I struggle, but I know that it's part of coping right now. You can keep sharing your moments of joy again on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.